Lasergate sends you inside the computer. It's 1200 XL. Hi, everybody. Welcome to 1200 XL. I'm John.
And I'm Aaron.
And today, Aaron, we're talking about freaking Lasergate, man.
Yes.
Listen.
Finally.
What is it? What is it about the space shooter that keeps people coming back year after year, generation after generation?
Listen, you know, the space shooters are a lot like pizza, right? Even when they're bad, they're still pretty good. You know what I mean? You get in there, you shoot crap, you're flying around, there's a certain amount of freedom. And, you know, sometimes you sit down to play a game and you don't want to, like, strategize or like, pound your head up against the wall. You know, you've had a long day on the job, you know. What you want to do is blow crap away. You know what I'm saying? Blow it up. See sparkles fall off of it. And this game has that in spades, Boaster.
Do you remember the very first space shooter that you played? Was it Galaxian?
No. It would have been Space Invaders, Boat. Would be easily be the first one because
do you have a memory of your first time playing Space Invaders?
I think the very first time I played it was at Hex, which is a department store, a long, long dead department store that was a chain around these parts.
I believe it's a Big Lots now.
Well, yeah, that the building's certainly still there. It's funny, in the foyer there when you walk in, that's where the games were. They had a Space Invaders, and they also had, that's where I played that Showdown or whatever, that, you know, the Gunman game.
Wild Gunman?
No, you know, the one where you have the two guys, the gunfight or whatever you call
it. Gunfight, yeah.
But, in fact, like I said, I'm not sure if I played Space Invaders or Gunfight first. It's close. But Space Invaders was, you know, hey, listen, it was big here, too. And, man, I'm telling you, people don't get it now, you know. But, like, brother, you saw that thing in the arcade. You're like, holy moly, what am I looking at here? What's in there? Is that a TV? You know, what's all this crap? You didn't know. You didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the sound in Space Invaders is, it's minuscule. But what they did, it's very creepy, you know, in a weird way. And your shooting sounds real interesting. It was just an alluring game. But it did set the stage for, you know, everyone's appetite to shoot aliens, you know, which, of course, movies and TV set the stage for that for, like, the the previous 50 years or so before that game came out. We were scared of being invaded by aliens. No one ever comes from space to, like, give you a hand. They're always coming to get you. You know,
thank God
you had this mobile cannon boat to, you know, kill these suckers.
So, you know, Space Invaders, obviously the first alien shooting game. But in your own life, I mean, how would you trace the family tree of Aaron in terms of what came after Space Invaders?
In terms of alien shooting?
Yeah.
Boy. I mean, there were a whole cavalcade of games that were, I would say, of my earliest gaming memories that would involve, like, asteroids, because there's a UFO in that. Would be in there. That was an early one. Then you had stuff. I'm trying to think of Pleiades, sort of Pleiotoid, something like that. I remember playing a game like that. Then, of course, there were plenty of those, like, sort of black and white games on a colored background. One of the ones I remember being real impressed with back in the day was Phoenix. I thought that game was awesome. I still do, by the way. It's a great game, you know, where you fight those birds. Someone mentioned in the chat, Gorf, exactly. Gorf talked. That was pretty impressive, you know. So I like that one. But, you know, when it comes to your sort of scrolling, if you think about today's game and kind of focus it back in the day, the closest you would probably get would be something like Scramble, which was another early game that I thought was real. I mean, I like Super Cobra better, but I love Scramble. I like that sort of going over an alien world. You know, bombing it. It's in some ways you're the enemy in that. You're the kind of the alien invading those worlds. So the tables were sort of turned. And what about you, Bo? Do you recall what you got into back when you were a child?
You know, it's funny. For me, it was Space Invaders, but it was not the Space Invaders that you know. For me, it was Space Invaders on the Atari 8-bit computer, which is a totally different game than the Space Invaders that came on the in the arcades. I remember reading about the development of Space Invaders on the Atari 8-bit, and it was basically like they gave the guy carte blanche to do whatever he wanted to do. And so in this version of Space Invaders, none of the Space Invaders looked like the Space Invaders that came out in the arcades. They emerged from a rocket ship that would, it started out at the top of the screen and it would slowly get down. And the way that you were able to choose your difficulty is that you'd have this rocket ship on the side of the screen and it would slowly descend. And so the advanced difficulty level meant that the rocket ship was closer to the Earth and the aliens would emerge from there. The idea that you would have bases where you could hide behind, the bases would absorb damage, none of that was present in the Atari 8-bit version of the game. It's interesting in that the fact that, you know, Space Invaders for the Atari VCS was kind of the killer app. It was the thing that moved the systems. And then when it came to the Atari 8-bit machines, they had a totally different take on it and a sort of inferior take.
Yes.
But I think at that time, they were trying to, you know, they didn't need to have an arcade perfect Space Invaders to move these computers because it was a machine that was supposed to also do your taxes and whatever else it was. So
yeah, I've played that 8-bit version, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I kind of like the rocket idea pretty good. But I mean, you called it. The thing is, the 2600 version of Space Invaders, they could have phoned it in. You know what I mean? Because they knew it wasn't going to be as good as the arcade, because the TV didn't have the resolution to put that together. And, you know, it was also the orientation was different. But what it lacks in, like, overall Space Invaders, it makes up for just in the sheer volume of options they give you.
Yeah.
And the options, again, much like, say, an Asteroids, like those old Atari games, and again, this is a pet peeve of mine when I watch new people try this stuff, and I'm like, it's okay. Meh. You know, if you give it a chance, there's a million great options in both those games that make it a lot of fun. I don't recall there being a ton of options in the 8-bit.
They didn't sell that at all, and so you don't get your invisible invaders. You don't get your invisible ship. None of that stuff is there. Because they realized that by the time that they were putting this out for the Atari 8-bit, they didn't need that to move the console, and that's the secret ingredient of almost every single like game that came out in say that 78-79 time period for the VCS is that, and they even market it. They'd say like this is 87 video games, you know, on one cartridge, and it was true. It was true. The options are what make those games.
Yeah, and if you really need to have the book or something to like play some of those old games, I mean, and the options and even the difficulty switch and stuff, they make the games a lot more fun because they had to do everything they could to give you as much as they could with the minuscule amount they could on offer. And so they had to be very clever, and they were very clever in those old days.
Yeah. Now, my first side scrolling shooter that I ever played in my life, you know, it wasn't Life Force, it wasn't R-Type, it was this game. It was Laser Gates.
Really?
Yeah. So Aaron, let's get into it. Let's talk about Laser Gates.
Boat, it's amazing to me that this was your first game for a bunch of reasons. But you're gonna have to explain some people who are surprised that this popped up on 1200XL. Can you give us a scoop on this, Boat?
Absolutely. Well, you know, as a child, my dad brought home the 1200XL one evening, probably I would say in 1986 or 1987, well past the time where the Atari 8-bits were relevant on sort of the stage. But he brought it home because this was going to be his work computer. And he bought it from one of his colleagues at Union Carbide, and this was going to be his machine. And so he set this up in the study, and it wasn't long before he realized that the Atari 8-bits were lacking in certain ways that were conducive to proper business usage.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't long until he got himself a nice XT clone, you know, the old 8088 special. And the 1200XL was moved from the study into the living room. And then that's when it really became my computer. I had siblings, but they were young. They didn't know anything. And I told them to get out of there because it was my computer. We got most of our software from a connection that my dad knew at work. A guy named Skid Kennedy. His first name was Skid, Aaron.
That's pretty cool. His real name?
I think that that's his Christian name. That was his given name, Skid Kennedy.
Gutsy. I like it.
Every once in a while, you know, he'd get together with Skid, and all of a sudden he'd come home with a box full of floppy disks, okay? And that's where I'd say 90% of my Atari 8-bit games were found, were all these floppy disks. And they all came with these loaders. So you'd load up a game, and you wouldn't have to go into DOS or anything like that. They'd come with a custom loader, and it would be like, press 0 to play Pac-Man, press 2 to play Laser Gates. And so I'd be, Laser Gates, that sounds cool. So I'd press 2, Laser Gates would show up, and there it would be. So this is how the first, you know, horizontally shooter game that I played was Laser Gates. It was a pirate copy from Skid Kennedy. So Skid, thank you. Skid is not with us anymore. Skid was already aged back in the 80s, so I don't think he's with us anymore. But anyway, this is Laser Gates, Aaron, and I'm going to let the cat out of the bag right away. This game was never commercially released on its own for the Atari. This game was originally a 2600 game. It did get an Atari 8-bit port, but it was only released on a four pack of games that was basically an iMagic 4-pack. So it was never released on its own.
I think it was like iMagic 1-2-3 or something was the name
okay,
of it.
Okay, yeah. It was probably a 3-pack rather
than
a 3.
I think it was a 3-pack. And I was reading, it's rated as a rarity 9. And I couldn't find a single picture of anything involving the box or the floppy.
Me neither. So this is basically what you have here is a port of a 2600 game. So a lot of this information, we're going to take it sort of on faith that the same people were involved in the Atari 8-bit version that were involved in the 2600 version, although that may not be correct. And if it's not correct, please leave us a comment on YouTube and let us know the real story, because I've looked all over for it and I cannot find it.
Yeah, this is a tough one to research.
Yeah, this game was programmed by a guy named Dan Oliver. Dan Oliver did 5 games, all of them for the 2600, for a variety of companies, from iMagic to Venture Vision to Apollo to Atari. You know, Venture Vision I haven't heard of. The game that he did on there is called Rescue Terror 1. It's rated on Atari Age as a rarity 9. So I'm reckoning that most people do not know about that. But Space Cavern was by Apollo. Apollo is one of those companies, much like iMagic. They sprung up sort of in Atari's wake in the early 80s and came to their demise with the video game crash in Atari 2600 crash in 1983/1984. The publisher of this title was iMagic. iMagic, of course, notable as being only the second third-party developer for the Atari 2600. The first one, as everyone knows, is Activision. But some of the other Atari alumni got together and said, hey, if Activision can do it, so can we. And they broke off. They made their own company. And they listen, they put out some of the best titles, not only for the VCS, but for all of that sort of, I guess you'd call it second generation consoles.
Yeah.
The Atari, the ColecoVision, the Intellivision, all of that stuff they were part of. They did Atlantis, which Aaron I know is one of your favorites.
Yep.
Cosmic Arc, Demon Attack.
Another one.
Yeah. I mean, these guys were just all over the place with the hits. Aaron, what do you think of when you think of iMagic?
You know, it comes to mind. Well, you mentioned all the games. I love those games. And there's more. All right. But one thing that I think of is they're really cool, like silver cartridge. The cartridges were wrapped in silver, like stickers. And the boxes usually had like actual like photographic art of different stuff on it, and the boxes were all silver too, and they usually had like orange or a bright color for the tag. It was always super eye-catching like paraphernalia there, their boxes and labels. So that's They were very good at getting a good look. I think they were way better than even Activision. I mean, if you look at Activision stuff, it's definitely looks like Activision. It's all like one big group, but it's not nearly as eye catching as the iMagic stuff.
Well, what it is they saw that Activision had a gimmick. You know, Activision's gimmick was, you know, line art, very sort of cartoony, flat perspective, realizations of screenshots, basically. You know, you'll always be able to see an Activision game. It's got that, you've got a main character that's got a rainbow following behind him, kind of tracing his movement. And then iMagic, really, I think they took sort of what you might see on an old computer magazine, something like an old issue of Analog or Byte or something like that, where they take something that was almost photorealistic, but still, you know, an illustration. They kind of had that kind of airbrushed look to it, but it was a totally different look from both what Atari was doing. You know, and I can't think, the guy's name escapes me, but he's sort of the crowning hero of art on the Atari system. But but they take, you know, it was different than him, but it was also different than what Activision was doing. So totally, you know, to be honest with you, Aaron, it kind of reminds me of what you might see more on an Odyssey 2 title. Do you see any similarities between the Odyssey 2 box art and the iMagic art?
The Odyssey 2 box art was, well, so here's the thing. And the Odyssey 2 box art also great, but it's pretty much illustrated. Like a lot of these, me and Brent on ARG, I think it was covered, I think it was Cosmic Arc, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of money they spent on the box photo was ridiculous because that had a model on it and it was a posed model and stuff. I mean, they used a lot of actual real life photos that they would, and they would make models of some of ships and stuff, you know, and take the photos. So I remember I read how much it cost them to take the photo. It was like a ludicrous amount, like 10 G's or something, you know, some stupid amount, you know. And so most of their boxes had like they had a game out for the television that had a vampire in it. So you got a vampire on the box, you know, and they've got games that have rockets like Atlantis. They've got like a model city on the front, like that they put together. So like they, and I like that. It set them apart. And when you add the, you know, I was a young boy. And so when you've got that cool reflective silver foil type cover, and then you've got the cool photo, you're in. That was what young Aaron was down. They were the psychosis of their day, basically. They knew, they tapped into what people my age wanted to see, and it was cool crap like that.
Absolutely. And Cliff Spahn, by the way, he's the guy that really kind of, when you think about that distinctive Atari 2600 box art, Cliff Spahn is the guy that really, really pioneered that.
That
and you're
stuff
right.
Is great. That's another, I mean, that's a whole different type of art, but I mean, we both love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And here's, I mean, let's, who's kidding who? When you're selling Atari 2600 games or even Atari 8-bit games, you've got to do something besides post an image of the screenshot.
Yeah.
Because what you want to have is you want the player to be sort of inspired by what they see on the box, and they can mentally transfer that onto the very low pixel count of the game.
And I think that's what Odyssey 2 did great. They were, I mean, when it comes, when you played like Quest for the Rings, they had all the dragons and monsters and stuff, and they looked great, and the art was solid. And the internal books and stuff were all super well illustrated. That was your novella of the day. Like the instructions, the box, the box art, the fonts. That's what helped you set the scene for something that was not going to be that good looking.
Exactly. And so this is, you know, I think it's great. I think that of the, you know, the major publishers on the VCS and also on the Atari 8-bit, you've got, you know, the top three are definitely Atari. Their in-house staff was out of sight. Activision with that line-drawn look. And then iMagic is definitely a solid, you know, in that top three. You're right. You can't undersell the shininess of that metallic finish.
Yeah.
Plus the photorealistic art, you know, it was a winning combination. Plus it made their titles stand out. Yeah. I remember thrifting, you know, back in the days when people actually did that. And thumbing through carts, and you always pick up the iMagic carts because they're the only ones that have that aluminum foil. Yeah, that aluminum foil.
They also had a different shape. On like the 2600, they had like a little lip that you could help, you know. So they were, that's what made them stand out. They knew, listen, the guys were clever. And if it's funny, as I recall, iMagic went public like right when the video game crash happened, as I recall. And so, like, they never got a chance to be a big player after the crash like Activision did. It's a shame because you had some real wise people putting out some good stuff back in then.
Exactly, exactly. So let's talk about Lasergate. So this game is at its root, it is a horizontal cavern shooter. I would say, you know, you always go back to Scramble. Everything goes back to Scramble. This is a game in the Scramble genre, where you are flying and the screen is scrolling horizontally. You're flying a little spaceship and you are negotiating obstacles while blowing enemy combatants out of the sky. This game does come with a little bit of a backstory. Aaron, were you aware that your ship in this game was called the Dante Dart?
No, that's a cool name.
I love that.
Yeah,
that's right. So in this game, what you have is it's almost like maybe Inner Space meets Tron. You are piloting your ship deep into something only known as the Cryptic Computer. The Cryptic Computer. And your job is to destroy 4 fail-safe detonators, okay? If you neglect to destroy all 4 of these fail-safe detonators, the computer will malfunction and it will obliterate the universe. It will be the end of time.
So, oh, wow.
The stakes are always high in these games.
No kid.
And so anyway, you are moving throughout this area, and this computer, it doesn't look like your normal garden variety computer on the inside. You know, when you think about, if I think about flying inside a computer, what I would think about is maybe, you know, circuit boards and traces and things like that. But in this game, it almost looks like you're flying inside a little city. You have what appears to be some vegetation. You've got some shrubbery. You've got things that look like housing units, some residential areas. You've got towers. You've got power stations. It's almost like a little city within the computer. Aaron, did you ever, you know, when you were playing computer games as a lad, did you ever think about, you know, how games were represented in the circuitry itself? Did you think about them as little cities like this?
Well, you know, after I saw Tron, I did. But I don't think I did before that. You know, and I will say the representation here. I'm looking at as we're talking. I'm looking at the video here, and this game, to do it justice, you really need to play it because the visuals in this. I don't think I've ever seen a game that had the same sort of shimmering. I don't know what, like, you know, talk about not having traces. That's sort of what they remind me of. There's everything in this game is interconnected with this like circuitry. Or it looks like electrical wiring, whatever you want to call it. And it's, you know, Atari had this excellent graphical gimmick where you could get this weird shimmer. You see it in a lot of games, I've never seen it quite used like this. And what it gets is, I mean, you really get a feeling like you're in, like, either super electrified alien world or inside a computer. I mean, it's one of those things that reminds me sort of like playing a Vectrex. Like, you can't really tell on an HDMI screen when you sit down. Like, you really need to sit down and play this, like, in the natural setting to get the full effect, because it's quite an effect. And this is a graphical tour de force, in my opinion, the way this game looks. I mean, and that shimmer is a big, huge part of it, but it's not the only part. And I'll let you get to it. I know you're going to get to it. But, yeah, I think the shimmering and stuff and the way that they've tried to render an internal inside the computer is at top flight.
Yeah, and so, you know, if we dip back into the lore just briefly here, you've got something called the Universal Squeeze. I felt that before.
Yeah.
The Universal Squeeze. With these flashing columns of light that come down and meet in the middle. You've got flexing force fields, homing missiles, rock munchers, and bite bats. All of these things are in your way. The thing that makes Lasergate's, well, I mean, there's a lot of things that sort of make this game stand out. And one of the things is that this game has a HUD That gives you real-time feedback on both your energy level and your shields. Now, in today's day and age, this is not a big deal. Every game does this. But for 1984, there weren't a whole lot of games that actually, first of all, gave you an energy meter, but also you're dealing with two different rapidly depleting forces here. You've got your energy, which is your fuel, essentially, and then you also have your shields. And so you're keeping track of two different things at the same time. So this is sort of, you know, as I said, the game is you're essentially moving through four different zones within the computer, trying to destroy these fail-safe mechanisms so the computer can be destroyed and the universe is saved. Now, Aaron, when you first played Laser Gates, what did you think about it?
Good question. Because I originally played this back in the day, and I'd, to be honest with you, I totally forgotten about it until you had this fired up at your house one time when I came for a visit. And I'm like, oh, I got to get some of this. And, of course, the second I looked at it, I'm like, oh, this rings a bell. You know, when we were doing the show, when you were like, listen, let's do Laser Gates. And I started just, I had a brief look into the backstory and stuff. And the fact that this wasn't formally released is baffling to me. Like, I'm like you. We got this, my neighbor had an Atari. We got this through nefarious means, you know. And I just assumed this was a real popular big title. So I'm, and so today, and or this week, when I'm sitting here researching, I'm stunned that this is a very unknown title, because we know about it, and we love it. It's the I like, you know, normally these heads up displays, and I will say this game's guilty of it too. Probably a third of the screen is almost half the screen is taken up with gauges and like a thing that tells you what planet you're on by the color. So you're really only playing with about half of a screen. You know, but I will say, and normally we kill that, don't we, Bode? We hate that.
We do.
But
we hate it.
There's a reason that you don't kill it, okay? And it's not just because I have some kind of unbridled love for this. It's because this game is basically a vertical shooter stretched horizontally. They've taken the limited space and they've miniaturized the play field. Don't take that the wrong way, but it's sized perfectly. So you could literally, if you turn this thing straight up, it'd be like playing a vert game. If you're playing it the way that they did it, it works well. This game wouldn't have, if it'd been full screen, you wouldn't work as well, because you sort of need the kind of constricted area, play area, to make the game work with the shield aspect and the stuff. The gauges are fine. It tells you how long you've got left. It's got your score. It's got all the stuff you need. I mean, again, the bottom parts of the HUD you don't really need. It shows what planet you're on. For anything, you can tell the color of the planet by the color of the planet that you're in. You don't really need something to tell you. But I think they just stuck that down there to fill empty space, frankly. But the rest of it, I think the HUD works well, and I like the graphical setup. So this is one of the rare occasions where I'm not going to dock too many points for the screen being half used.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, this game is a classic for me. It's rare, really. I mean, you're always fighting nostalgia whenever you take a look at a game like this after the fact. You know, I grew up playing this game. You know, probably dozens of hours were spent when I was a kid playing Laser Gates. And looking back on it now, there's a lot of things that I notice now that I had no idea about then that make me appreciate it. So it's really a happy accident. This game, we could have easily came up here and killed. You know, it's a game that I liked when I was a kid because I didn't know any better. This game truly deserves a lot of the plaudits. Like I said, this is probably one of the saddest stories of a game that was never released that deserved a release, and I'll tell you why. In this game, you are scrolling from left to right, and it's a race against time in three different factors, okay? You've got 3 minutes to make it through each one of these levels. You have a clock that is ticking down the time, okay? You have some control over how fast these levels scroll. Even though this is an auto-scroller, you can get right up next to the right of the screen, and you can actually push this game faster than it would normally auto-scroll. So that's important to remember, okay? How does this game slow you down? Okay. This game slows you down by introducing a series of I don't know if they're concrete, but we'll call them concrete because that will put the right picture in your brain. Concrete columns that you have to blast through, okay? And in this game, this is one of these games, it's got the brilliant mechanic that it will let you have a certain number of shots on screen at once, but whenever you're firing into these concrete pillars, you know, your shots are disappearing. So it's almost like you have this rapid fire mechanism, and the way that you blast into these concrete pillars is very, very satisfying. You can really tear into these things, and you can see the damage that you're causing with your laser, which is cool. And the idea is this is another push your luck type factor, because the screen is always scrolling. You're trying to clear a space that's just wide enough for your ship to get through. If you want to make it wider, you can, but you're risking being pushed by the auto scroll. But if you make it too narrow and you aim poorly, your ship won't be able to make it through and you will take damage. Because that's the second thing that your ship has, is you have these shields, and these shields are finite. You have a gauge that's ticking down, that every time that you get hit, your shields go down. In addition to the time and the energy and the shields, you also have energy. And energy is also a ticking time bomb that will eliminate your life if you're unable to reach the end of the stage in time. So this is a perfect kind of push your luck game, because you are trying to get through to the end of the stage without depleting your energy or your shields, but you don't want to go too fast because these concrete pillars get in your way and they will deplete your shields to the point where you will die. Now you might be asking yourself, well, why didn't they just do one or the other? Why? It seems like time and energy are the same thing. Well, they are, sort of. But the thing is, energy will deplete much, much faster than your time. Say you've got, 3 minutes of time to get through a stage in this game. Your energy, if you let your energy run down, it will probably only give you about a minute and a half of time. Okay. And so to replenish your energy in each one of these levels, there is one spot that's like a landing pad that has a big E on it. And this is something that I never knew when I was a kid. I didn't have the sort of mental capacity to understand what was going on. If you land on this landing pad, it will replenish your energy and allow you to complete the stage. Because many times I would be playing this game and I'd blow up and I'd have no idea why, because I'd have no idea that there was a way that you could extend your energy.
Didn't I show you that?
Maybe it was you.
One that showed you that back when we first started playing this back in the day.
You're probably right. I was going to say, because nobody ever told me about it. So it was probably you, Aaron, that showed me how to do this. And so this is the only way that you can actually get to the end of each stage and blow up the main computer. Now, it's kind of funny. On the original version of Laser Gates, you have a computer chip. It says 6507 on it, I believe. That is the processor that was inside the Laser Gates, the VCS version. However, on the unreleased the very rarely released 2600 version, you see 6502 there, which is the processor found in the Atari 8-bit game. So they did carry that over. This is something that I can't believe a game this polished, this good looking, this well thought through was negated to just this 3-in-1 cartridge for the Atari 8-bit. It boggles my mind. Aaron, give me your total rundown on this game. What do you think?
Well, you know, I agree with everything you said. It is baffling to me. In fact, before this episode, I didn't know there was a VCS version of this. I'd never played the VCS version of this. I'd only played the 8-bit. I agree. There's some things this game does right that few games do. Okay, I'm going to go through a couple. The whole shooting the shield thing, it works great in this. And what they've got a shootable shield, then they've got the laser shield. Okay, the laser gate, as if you will. And sometimes, they come down differently. Sometimes they move. Sometimes one can be embedded in the other one, you know, as you go through. So sometimes they come down like a smasher. The funny thing about this game is you almost always die from running out of energy as opposed to shields. So sometimes you're better off just barreling through stuff. You get a goodly amount of shields will hold up pretty well. But it's usually the energy that's usually what gets me. I love the idea of landing and getting some of that energy. I think that's great. This game sort of reminds me of Vanguard a little bit, the horizontal levels of Vanguard in that aspect. You can tell the same guys that worked on Atlantis worked on this, because you can tell by the way the landscape's drawn. There's a lot of stuff that if you see Atlantis, you could tell a lot of similarities. So, of course, I'm a big Atlantis fan, so I like that. One thing this game does, it's funny, this game doesn't have tons and tons of, like, alien characters that come up to you. But what they'll do is, if you don't kill them, they'll linger, they'll come in from behind.
And yeah, so these guys don't just sort of, you know, go from the right of the screen and then pass you by on the left like most shooters do. Like you said, they will linger, and they will either linger on the screen or they will go off screen slightly, and then when you least expect it, they'll come back on from the other direction.
And one of the things, and I mean, listen, neither one of us are real fond of, like, weird shapes that linger around, but I will say, the weird shapes that come to this game, they do open up an interesting gameplay element, which is, you can turn around and shoot the other way. The scroll keeps going, but you can turn around. And this is one of the few games I've played with that sort of defendery sort of element that actually controls great. Like, yeah. I can actually turn around and fire and, like, not suck. Like, I'm tearing it up, you know, because you can fly the long. It's almost, this reminds me of playing one of those games in the arcade where they have, like, a double screen. That's what it reminds me of. Because you get a ton of space horizontally, tons of it, like double the space you'd get in most games. And so this allows you to do stuff like go forward real far, turn that sucker around, pick those suckers off from behind, you know, and you can do it. You can even shoot walls from behind if you want to, if you take the notion to, I guess, for points. But I love that. I love the elements of the game and when you combine them all with the shields and the overall aesthetic, it's a real winner. The sound effects are just exactly what you would expect. Sort of like if you've ever played Parsec on the TI, this game sort of reminds me of that. It's sort of a similar sort of setup as Parsec. It doesn't have the cool voices, but it's the laser sound is cool. The way your jet looks, or your, what do you call that thing, the dart?
Yeah, it's the Dante dart.
Like, it looks good. It doesn't look like a garbage. It's not just a triangle or something. It's a solid-looking ship. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't have anything negative to say about this. I think this is a top-tier Atari 800 game or Atari 8-bit game. And, I mean, I don't know how many people know about it because, like I said, I'm much like yourself. I sort of tried to do a little research on it, and I was flabbergasted at the low amount of stuff I could find on it. There's just nothing out there on it.
Well, you know, even the 2600 version that came out, it's still pretty uncommon to find anybody that's writing anything about it. Part of it is the fact that it was released in 1983, so we're right on the cusp of the crash. And so, you know, this
was
one of the...
Had you played this on the 2600 boat?
No, never.
Did you know it existed?
Not until I started researching this game, because I've never seen a cart of this. And I've seen so many Phoenix carts. I've seen so many Atlantis carts. I've seen tons of iMagic carts for the 2600. Never once have I seen a Laser Gates.
And if you look at these, we're looking at them side by side. Like, if I didn't tell you that they were the same game, or the same name anyway, like, there's a slight resemblance. But, I mean, and God bless the 2600, but I mean, this is like, you're in a whole different stratosphere on the 8-bits. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the 2600 game, it looks quite remedial compared to, and the thing is, I think the 2600 I will say the 2600 have a whole lot of vertical scrolling, like, games like this, that there are not a ton of them, so it does deliver on the gates and stuff, but it's far less elegant than the 8. Trust me, play the 8-bit version, I guess is what we're saying.
Here my personal feelings on this is that this game was, of course, originally planned to be a full retail release for the 8-bits. Once the crash happened, iMagic really ran into some financial straits. They tried to kind of gather whatever they had and kind of combine it into one last gasp to make some money. They're like, if we combine three of these games into one cart, maybe people will buy it. The wrong move, iMagic, of course, out of business. They did not survive the crash. I believe.
Did your research determine, like, did the 2600 version come out earlier? Is that
yes.
why it
oh,
made
yeah.
it out?
Yeah, absolutely. The Atari 2600 version was the lead development platform on this.
I say.
And
because you're right, timing is everything. And this, the copyright on this does say 84, so this would have been right when everything tanked.
Yeah, looks like their company was liquidated in 1986, and after 83, things were never the same.
Yeah, well, this right here, Boat, I'm going to give you credit. This is one of the highest level hidden gems you're ever going to find on any computer, in my opinion. Like, if you're a fan of shooters, if you're a fan of horizontal games where you have to negotiate your way through barriers or whatnot, sort of like a Vanguard, like, I can't imagine you not being into this. And if you're just into good-looking games, this is,
and if you're listening to this on via podcast, do yourself a favor. You don't have to watch our video. Just do a quick search on YouTube for LaserGate's Atari 8-bit and look at the way that these cities are rendered with the circuitry that connects them all. Like you said, that flashing circuitry.
Yeah.
It's a look that has never really been duplicated in turn. You know, I've played hundreds of Atari 8-bit games. I've never seen something that looks exactly like this with as much going on the screen. It's really a fantastic game, and it's, you know, if this was iMagic's swan song, what a swan song.
I agree, and iMagic, a great company. If you're going to go out, like, this is a good one to go out on, especially just from the artistic standpoint of it. I mean, it's a real beautiful, interesting-looking game.
Yeah. All right, Aaron, what do we have coming up next week, next time on 1200XL?
Well, I took the Liberty boat. In fact, that sounds like a boat I would take, the Liberty boat.
Oh, hey, before you announce it, move us on back up, Aaron, to the old game scene, because
we
did get one review.
We did?
And I would be remiss. I would be much remiss to not be able to give a shout out to our one and only Pajaco 6502. Where he says, LaserGate's part scramble, part defender, and not as good as either. In principle, the game ticks a lot of boxes for early 80s space shoot 'em ups, but the game is flawed in the implementation of the energy system. As you fly through caverns, you use energy, and there seems no way to conserve it, and so you fly along desperately, waiting for an energy charger to appear so you can recharge enough to get to the final boss CPU thing, when you can then shoot the heck out of it and go at it again. But here's the whammy. Miss the energy recharger or mess up your recharge, and you're on a one-way ticket to Death City. You know you aren't going to make it to the end, but the game makes you play through anyway. If you're going to do this sort of thing, then either make it a checkpoint or do what Scramble did and have something to shoot to get energy back. And because this is a fresh coat of paint on a VCS game, the variety is lacking, which is not a bad thing, as this is a game for high score rather than completion. So for its time, not a bad arcade-style game and has the look and feel, but gameplay-wise, this one doesn't quite hold up today, but it's worth giving this one a shot. 6 out of 10.
Oh.
Jacques, man, not a fan.
I disagree. Although I can understand his point, but no, I think this is a 10 out of 10, personally. It's me.
Me too.
I think this is a great one. And he's right. If you miss the energy, you could be boned.
Dims the brakes, as they say.
You're right. So getting back to next week's show's game, I took the liberty of picking this one. And so I told Bodas, I got, you know, I'm going to look and see what was popular amongst our peers. You know, so I looked to see what was. And though this game proved Atari Mania to be the highest rated game, and I thought to myself, my God, we've never played it. And so we're going to be playing this special game on the next show. Let's fire it up here, Boaster. Bam. It's Flob. This is a game from 2021 that I've never heard of, and Boat's never heard of it either.
Nope.
The truth of the matter is, this is the highest rated game on Atari Mania, and I felt like we would be remiss without giving it a whirl, Boat.
I cannot wait to play Flob. And I never thought I'd say that. So, guys, thank you as always. Of course, we release 1200XL, some might say sporadically. We don't have what you call a regular release schedule. But we do enjoy whenever we get together and talk about the Atari 8-bit. And, hey, listen, if you are listening to this, you should tune in just a couple days or after the fact on YouTube. We call him the Good Doctor. Drone Doctor has sent us a package. 3 or 4 big boxes are over there on my table right now waiting to be unboxed. Atari 8-bit goodness. Tune in and check out what he sent us, the goodness that the Drone Doctor has sent us. Guys, thank you so much for watching 1200XL. We will see you next time. And until then, make sure you play
your Atari today. Do it.